going to begin a Hind Let Loose. I want to take us through the book A Hind Let Loose by Alexander Shields. It was first written in 1687. Full title is A Hind Let Loose, or an historical representation of the testimonies of the Church of Scotland for the interest of Christ, with the true state thereof in all its periods, together with the vindication of the present testimony against the popish, prelatical, and malignant enemies of that church, as it is now stated, for the prerogatives of Christ, privileges of the church, and liberties of mankind, and sealed by the sufferings of a reproached remnant of Presbyterians there, witnessing against the corruptions of the time, wherein several controversies of greatest consequence are inquired into, and in some measure cleared, concerning the hearing of the curates, owning of the present tyranny, taking of ensnaring oaths and bonds, frequenting of field meetings, defensive resistance of tyrannical violence, with several other subordinate questions useful for these times. If that's not provocative, I I don't think you realize what we're about to get into. We're going to cover the preface to the reader and the introduction this week. And they actually, I think, provide a reasonably good orientation to the book. Shields did a pretty good job. The first edition of the book was published without attribution. His name was kept back. And that was because at the time, his name on the book would have been almost a guarantee that he would have been apprehended, and if apprehended, executed by the civil magistrate. Some of that will become apparent as we get into some of the questions that he doesn't delve into in the title. We're going to cover in the book, we will be covering what is in essence a survey of the history of Christianity in Scotland from its very beginning until the time the book was written in 1687. Now, these periods are broken down and into several sections, and each one he will tell us not only what happened, but he's going to give us some pointers as to why it's important. So we're going to see the state of the church in the early church. We'll see what happens with deforming. We'll actually see, and he's going to show us that the Church of Scotland is really a late addition to communion with the Roman Church. By the time the Reformation arises in the 1500s, Scotland had only been Romanized for maybe 400 years. That's a lot. But when you consider that a lot of Europe had been Romanized or fallen into a lot of the corruptions for 800 years plus, it doesn't seem like it's so much. The other thing that we'll see is during that same period of time, while a lot of the European churches were becoming more and more corrupt, the Scottish church, because it was independent, it was isolated. If you've ever been to Scotland, if you ever go to Scotland, you will notice that right at the border of England and Scotland, there's a wall. That wall is called Hadrian's Wall. The Roman Emperor Hadrian built that wall to keep the barbarians out of England. They thought that anyone north of the border, that is all the Scots, were barbarians.
They thought that they were not
keyed into, let's just say, polite European society, which is why they didn't go along with all of the corruptions that were coming into the church. They actually continued to represent for a much longer time a much more primitive form of Christianity, which had been brought there by St. Columba and St. Patrick much earlier. We'll get into that when he gives us the history. We'll talk about some of that. But by the time the Reformation comes to Scotland, the people have had it with Romanism. Unlike England and other places in Europe, Scotland, although they had a king, the king in Scotland had to negotiate with the lords, the big land owners, and the clans. They had to deal with situations that really fettered them in ways that didn't happen to chief magistrates in most other countries in Europe by that time. So it's a very different situation there. And although Shields does not get into all of that so much, I'm telling you that to give you a little bit of a sense of why Scotland remains different and distinct. And this idea that they're sort of out there, they're at the far end, literally, of the Roman Empire. And they're just outside of the border of the Roman Empire through the time of the Roman Empire. I mean, Hadrian's Wall is the far north of the Roman Empire. And they're just north of that. So, Scotland is a different country and has a very different history. Because it was and is rugged terrain, relatively speaking, it was not the kind of place, and it's during the winter, it's cold and dark, and there were a lot of reasons. Most people stayed away. And if you went to war with the Scots and they beat you, it was going to be, the retaliation would be horrible. So you didn't want to fall into their hands if you failed. You know, these are all different things. And by the way, Shields is going to tell some stories about Scottish kings who fell afoul of the Scottish lords. And their end was not a good one. The Scots have a long history of saying no to tyrants. So it's not, you shouldn't be surprised that a lot of the ideas that Calvin is enunciating and the Calvinistic theory of political resistance, that's going to really take root in Scotland. More so than anywhere else, it's going to take root there. It's finding a receptive audience there. And when we spell out the history of Western jurisprudence,
what does that mean?
Legal history, right? The body of law with regard to nations. With the Reformation, there's an end of feudalism. Romanism was congenial to a feudalistic organization of society. The Reformation the Reformation creates, and this is in France, the Huguenots, the French Calvinists, among them we see for the first time in the history of the world the rise of the middle class, tradesmen, middlemen, merchants, and things like that. Capitalism arises with the rise of the middle class, and economics gets turned on its head in ways that had never happened before. That's the result of the Protestant Reformation. Now, in addition to that, if we were to look at the trajectory of Western jurisprudence and the theory of nations. There are three books which, in some respect, informed Western political theory more than anything else, other than the Bible, more than anything else in the history of the world. First is Calvin's Institutes. Because Calvin really sets down certain boundaries when he talks about politics and in the Institutes. Now, that's not to say he goes as far as certain Calvinists on the continent. John Ponet, in 1556, wrote a treatise on political power where he openly advocates tyrannicide. There's another book which...
Tyrannicide, what does that mean? Like
killing a tyrant. You have the right to kill a tyrant. Among the Huguenots, there's a book published anonymously. There's been some dispute as to who wrote the book. Might have been one of the Dumoulins. We're not really sure. It's called A Defense of Liberty Against Tyrants, 1578. Another Calvinist treaty that made the kings of Europe tremble. Because unlike what, the Pope during the Middle Ages made Henry go to Canossa, to the Palace of Canossa, and bow in the snow and do penance and repair his relationship with the Pope. That had been the history of Europe through the Middle Ages. The papacy basically told the political powers what they would do and when they would do it. When Henry VIII broke with Rome, there was an interdict that the Roman Church put. No one in England could receive the Mass legally, lawfully, while the king was unreconciled to the Pope, and that threatened Henry's security, because people at the time believed you can't receive the Mass, you can't possibly be saved. So all of a sudden, they thought, all the people were beginning to think they couldn't be saved. So that led to the British government, the English government, I should say, organizing what we now know as the Anglican Church, the Church of England. That was a partial reform, but it was Erastian. And we'll get into Erastianism a bit later in the book, in Hind Let Loose.
Just a second ago, you mentioned that books like this book by the anonymous author, made the kings tremble. I don't know if radical is the right word, but like the reformation in thought that changed, was the idea of the power and authority of the king arising from God, and therefore you could have a tyrant?
The idea shifted, and people came to understand that the power of the king is not immediately from God; it's from God, but mediated through the people.
Okay, I see what you're saying. So prior to that, you could sit under the most harsh tyrant,
and if the Pope told you to do it, you had to do it.
Right. No questions asked.
No. Right. Didn't really matter what happened. Okay, so that... And everybody went along with this. For the longest time, they all went along with this. You know, everybody thought this was the way the world was organized. Which is strange, because in the early church, you do find ideas being kicked about that sound much more like what you're going to hear the Covenanters saying later on. Okay, it's not that what the Covenanters are saying is coming from nowhere. It's just There, Scotland was, in fact, far enough removed from the center of power. In other words, it was as it tried to centralize power in Europe, Scotland is way out there on the edge. And it was just, from a practical point of view, it was uncontrollable territory.
Was that because of the people or just the landscape?
Everything. Everything about it. Its remoteness, the people, everything about it. Okay. So in addition to those books, in 1558 you had Christopher Goodman, who was in Geneva. He was one of the English-speaking ministers there. He wrote a book called How Superior Powers Ought to Be Obeyed, which basically said that you have a right to rebel against a tyrant and, if necessary, kill him. John Knox, in 1558, wrote his first Blast of the Trumpet Against the Monstrous Regiment of Women, where he rejected the notion that any woman could possibly be a legitimate political power because it was contrary to nature. And in it, he discusses principles of... touch on this idea of tyrannicide. And he is, of course, the great apostle of Protestant Christianity in Scotland. I mean, he's not the first Protestant, but he becomes the most prominent and as we'll see, he becomes the most formative figure in Scotland. And he's a disciple of John Knox. In addition to, then, Calvin's Institutes, as being the foremost book, the next book, really, in English-speaking Western jurisprudence is 1644, Samuel Rutherford's Lex Rex, where he is setting forth, and not only is he saying that the law is king, rather than the king being law, he's actually at great pains to set forth the notion that tyranny is tyranny to a large extent because it's arbitrary and divorced from principles of natural morality. That book was sentenced under Charles I to be burned by the common hangman. They didn't like that book. It struck hard against arbitrary government, and that became the second book. And the third book that became important and we know in some ways actually informs what happens in the American Revolution is the book that we're going to be looking at for the next few weeks, Hind Let Loose. I say that because there's a defense in here of defensive arms. It's called Defensive Arms Vindicated. And Liberty Press has put out a volume of pamphlets from the time of the American Revolution. Someone took all of Shield's arguments. It was published anonymously in Orange County, New York. But they took all of his arguments for defensive arms and published them, denuding them of any reference to the covenants or getting too much into Scripture. They do get into Scripture, but not so much, you know, as Shields does. So it's basically word for word, except where it had to do with something that would let you know this was a covenant or defense. We also know that Thomas Jefferson, when he wrote the Declaration of Independence, had in front of him two things. One was there had been a bunch of group of Covenanters in Middlelock Terrera, Pennsylvania, just not too far from here, who in 1743 had renewed covenants, like the Arkansas Renovation, a renewed covenants with uplifted swords, and the governor of Pennsylvania found that very troubling. Those guys had to leave Pennsylvania, which was very strange because Pennsylvania was the land of toleration in the Quaker state. They were driven to North Carolina, where their immediate descendants wrote a document called the Mecklenburg Declaration, 1775. The proceedings at Middlelock Terrera in 1743 were printed by Ben Franklin in his shop in Philadelphia. The Mecklenburg Declaration was printed in Mecklenburg, North Carolina, by the descendants of these guys, and was in fact One of the two sources, along with the Renewal of Covenants, that we have reason to believe Jefferson had in front of him when he wrote the Declaration of Independence. So the arguments that we're getting into in this book have direct bearing. And if you've ever heard the old saying that was it Cousin America has run off with Presbyterian parson, is the way the English have described the American Revolution, there's a lot of truth to that. So a lot of the arguments that are there behind the American Revolution come from these arguments that we're going to see spelled out here. So what we're dealing with in this book are arguments and points of testimony bearing that are, in fact, matters of the testimony of the church. But beyond that, if you understand them, you will understand a little bit more about how America broke with England and why Covenanters are grieved with the path America took, having broken with England. They used the Covenanter arguments, but they rejected the Christian religion. The founding fathers were, by and large, deists. Nonetheless, on points of natural morality, they copy very closely the argument of Covenanters. And as I say, we know the book was being circulated and had an impact because there was an imprint of the chapter on defensive arms that was printed in Orange County, New York, somewhere around Duanesburg. And that would have been around the time of the American Revolution. And so the book we're going to be examining is one of three that set the course for Western jurisprudence and political theory. And although some of the things that we're going to talk about may sound radical in terms of where people are thinking today, at the time of the American Revolution, most of the Americans would have accepted the premises of everything that we're going to talk about here. Every one of these points that we'll talk about, that had become part of the culture. And you have to remember that between the German Reformed, they called them, I think, German Presbyterians sometimes, the German Reformed, the Dutch Reformed, the Scots-Irish, who were predominantly Presbyterian at the time of the American Revolution, somewhere around 80% of the early American colonists were probably Calvinistic. So it was a very high number of Calvinists, maybe more than anywhere in the world at that time. All right. So we're going to begin with the preface to the reader. Some of these I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about, but they're worth... others are worth a little bit more discussion. So the preface to the reader. Question one, what are Alexander Shield's two reasons for writing his preface? And the reasons he gives are, as you can see by the A and the B, twofold. Okay, first, he wants to give the reason for the title of the book. Hind Let Loose. What does that mean? Why is that an important thing? If you don't know what that means or the reference, if you're not familiar with the reference, he wants you to understand that. The second reason for writing the preface is he wants to set out the design of the work. He wants to give you heads up on the course he's going to take in the book. And he does say that, you know, as far as a lot of times books don't need a reason for their names. He says a lot of times people just arbitrarily name books if they don't have any real meaning. But he wants you to understand that his choice of title is not arbitrary, and it was not meant to be devoid of meaning. Right? Okay. Two, what does the name Naphtali connote in Scripture? If you look at Genesis 49:21, Naphtali, we're told, is a hind let loose. And furthermore, it is said of Naphtali, he giveth goodly words. So his choice of Naphtali is actually twofold itself. The hind let loose, he's interested in, actually he's going to tell you a little bit more about the hind let loose part of it, but he wants you to see it as a combination of these things. Naphtali, he points out, connotes a people who are not contented in Scripture to be slaves. Right? They're those who are seeking redemption, and they're wrestling with for the redemption promised, like in Genesis 30, verse 8, you know, Jacob wrestling with the angel. But they stand, importantly, in the context of Genesis 49, they stand in contrast to Issachar, who is described as a people couching under two burdens, becoming a servant to tribute. So, Naphtali, in the mind of Shields, connotes a people not given to slavery. They're not going to be happy to be slaves. They're not contented with that. And in contrast to Issachar, they're not going to couch down to bear the burden of any tyrant. Okay, so number three, then, what is the relationship between the name Naphtali and a hind let loose? Well, Genesis 49:21, Naphtali is a hind let loose. Naphtali means wrestling, and that wrestling leads to a loosing. And the idea that a people who are redeemed, giving goodly words, those they're bearing testimony to their Redeemer. So they're a wrestling. The story of the Church of Scotland, as Shields is going to present it, is that of a wrestling people. People wrestling to avoid this kind of bondage, and being redeemed, they're going to bear testimony to the Redeemer. That's the significance of this title, Hind Let Loose. Now, like a good preacher, not meant to be expository, it's not meant to be something like that. What Shields does next is he wants to list three or four similarities between the tribes of Naphtali and the Scottish Covenanters. The first, he points out from Deuteronomy 33:23 is the issue of geography. Naphtali and the Covenanters both are said to dwell in the west and the south. Okay, if you look at Deuteronomy 33:23, Naphtali dwells in the west and the south, and historically speaking, the Covenanters at this time that he's writing in 1687 were found mainly in the west and the south in Scotland. It's one of these happy coincidences that Shields is only too happy to point out to us. Okay, so the first similarity is geography. The second is Jeopardy. Like Naphtali, Covenanters jeoparded their lives for the interest of Christ. And we can see that if we were to look at Judges 4, 6, and 7, and 5, 18.
Judges 4, verses 6 and 7. And she sent and called Barak, the son of Abinoam, out of Kadesh Naphtali, and said unto him, Hath not the Lord God of Israel commanded, saying, Go and draw toward Mount Tabor, and take with thee 10,000 men of the children of Naphtali, and of the children of Zebulun, and I will draw unto thee, and I will draw unto thee to the river Kishon Sisera, the captain of Jabin's army, with his chariots and his multitude, and I will deliver him into thine hand.
Judges 5, verse 18. Zebulun and Naphtali were people that jeopardized their lives unto the death in the high places of the field.
And those verses, again, suggest another point of similarity between the tribe of Naphtali and the Covenanters. The third similarity he points out is loyalty, particularly this issue that's brought up. Like Naphtali, the Covenanters give goodly words expressing faithful testimony for their Redeemer. So geography, jeopardy, loyalty. And the fourth is tyranny. Like Naphtali, the Covenanters escape the burden of the tyranny of men because they're delivered by the Mighty One of Jacob. I want to look at Isaiah 49, 24 to 26, Isaiah 60, verse 16, and Matthew 4, 12 to 16.
Isaiah 49, verses 21 through 26. The earth is moved at the noise of their fall, at the cry of the noise thereof was heard in the Red Sea. Behold, he shall come up and fly as the eagle and spread his wings over Bozra. And at that day shall the heart of the mighty men of Edom be as the heart of a woman in her pangs. Concerning Damascus, Hamath is confounded and Arpad, for they have heard evil tidings. They are faint-hearted. There is sorrow on the sea. It cannot be quiet. Damascus is waxed feeble and turneth herself to flee, and fear hath seized on her. Anguish and sorrows have taken her as a woman in travail. How is the city of praise not left, the city of my joy? Therefore her young men shall fall in her streets, and all the men of war shall be cut off in that day, saith the Lord of hosts.
Isaiah 60, verse 16. Thou shalt also suck the milk of the Gentiles, and shalt suck the breast of kings, and thou shalt know that I, the Lord, am thy Savior and thy Redeemer, the Mighty One of Jacob.
In Matthew 4, 12 to 16.
Matthew 4, 12 to 16. Now when Jesus had heard that John was cast into prison, he departed into Galilee, and leaving Nazareth, he came and dwelt in Capernaum, which is upon the sea coast, in the border of Zebulun and Naphtali, that it might be fulfilled which was spoken by Isaiah, saying, the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali, by the way of the sea, beyond Jordan, Galilee, and the Gentiles.
That the first verse should have been Isaiah, I read Jeremiah. So Isaiah 49, 21 through 26. Then shalt thou say in thine heart, who hath begotten me these, seeing I have lost my children, and am desolate, a captive, and removing to and fro? And who hath brought up these? Behold, I was left alone. These, where had they been? Thus saith the Lord God, behold, I will lift up mine hand to the Gentiles, and set up my standard to the people, and they shall bring their sons in their arms, and thy daughters shall be carried upon their shoulders, and kings shall be thy nursing fathers, and their queens thy nursing mothers. They shall bow down to thee with their face toward the earth, and lick up the dust of thy feet, and thou shalt know that I am the Lord, for they shall not be ashamed that wait for me. Shall the prey be taken from the mighty, or the lawful captive delivered? But thus saith the Lord, even the captives of the mighty shall be taken away, and the prey of the terrible shall be delivered. For I will contend with him that contendeth with thee, and I will save thy children, and I will feed them that oppress thee with their own flesh, and they shall be drunken with their own blood as with sweet wine. And all flesh shall know that I, the Lord, am thy Savior and thy Redeemer, the Mighty One of Jacob.
Okay. So, similarities. Geography, dwell in the west and the south. Jeopardy, they're jeoparding their lives for the interest of Christ. Loyalty, they're giving good words, expressing faithful testimony for the Redeemer. And tyranny, they're going to escape the burden of tyranny. That's what they're doing, trying to escape the burden of tyranny. They don't want to bow down like Issachar between two burdens. All right. Five, does our author contend that he's advancing anything new in the realm of theological learning or political theory? He says, in fact, very clearly on this point that he is trying to advance nothing new or nice. He's just not interested in anything original. Now, in order to show that that's the case, he directs us to a series of other books, and I've given you room to write in these sources in number six to confirm the doctrines taught in this book. He's telling you, I'm lifting arguments, and I'm lifting them from these books. First, he points to the works of George Buchanan. Now, George Buchanan was noted, and actually I suspect a lot of Shield's history of Scotland is taken from George Buchanan's two-volume work on the history of Scotland. Buchanan was a Calvinist. He also happened to be the one who was appointed to teach James the Sixth, who became James the First of England. In his minority, George Buchanan was a good friend, famous friend of John Knox, and that's the second guy that is on the list. Shield says, read Knox. And again, Knox has a lot of things he's written, but the thing in particular I believe he has in mind is Knox's History of the Church of Scotland from the time of the Reformation of the Church of Scotland. That contains a lot of information that he is going to epitomize in this work. The third thing is he refers us to the works of one David Calderwood. And Calderwood wrote a lot on theological topics, controversies over theological issues regarding the proper administration of the Lord's Supper and the introduction of bishops and holy days and all kinds of other things. But Calderwood, again, is mainly, I think, brought forth here in the Calderwood's True History of the Church of Scotland in 1678. It was published, but Calderwood had been alive at the time of the Westminster Assembly, and he had also been alive toward the end of the period of the reign of James in Scotland before he went to England. Calderwood was one of a few ministers who were left from that earlier era who actually survives to the time of the Second Reformation and witnesses a lot of the turning back of the corruption introduced by the introduction of prelacy into Scotland. Right, the fourth thing that he advises are the Acts of General Assemblies. And that's because a lot of these things that he's going to talk about are documented in the Acts of General Assembly. They have a lot of little reports that they throw in these acts. Fifth thing that he references is causes of the Lord's wrath. That was written by James Guthrie, who was martyred in 1651. And by the way, Acts General Assemblies, he's almost certainly interested most of all in the Acts of General Assembly from 1638 to 49. But prior to that, he was probably interested in certain things that were going on in the Church of Scotland as well. But those are the ones that I think would most interest him, and he probably has mostly in mind to... Remember, he's trying to give us a list of things to corroborate what he's saying. So, Causes of Lord's Wrath, it was a document written by James Guthrie. He was a famous and faithful minister in the Church of Scotland who was, in fact, executed for writing the Causes of the Lord's Wrath. Causes of God's Wrath. Six. I mentioned this earlier. Samuel Rutherford's Lex Rex. Here is a tome on political theory that gives, I would say, the skeletal outline of a lot of the issues that Shields will address. They're going to, Lex Rex will provide a much more coherent system of political theory. John Brown of Wamfrey's book, Apologetical Relation, 1665. Brown of Wamfrey it's his first outing as a writer, an author. He was exiled and died in exile in Holland during the Killing Times, which we'll discuss. And he wrote a relation of the history of the Church of Scotland and a number of chapters about their contendings and about different points that were being discussed. And some of the discussions he has inform arguments that Shields will use, particularly when we get to the end of the book or the second half of the book, where we're dealing with the seven heads of doctrine that he, or seven heads of testimony that he wants to assert. Eighth, James Stirling and James Stuart of Goodtree's book, Naphtali. There's first edition, 1667, the second, 1693. This gets into starting to chronicle some of the constitutional violations of the Restoration and the persecutions that arise after the Restoration of Charles II in 1660. And that would be at the end of the Cromwellian era. Nine, James Stuart of Goodtrees wrote another book, Jus Populi Vindicatum. This book, 1669, is a continuation in some respects of Naphtali and gets into the question of resistance and the limits of obedience and constitutional matters in more detail. James Stuart of Goodtrees actually becomes a very prominent lawyer. Lord Advocate, after the Revolution in 1690. So he's well schooled in the law, and that is a big part of their argument. They're going to use the Bible. They're also going to use the law and show that they've actually violated their own laws, and that's really going to make them angry. And so again, Shields is going to have some reliance on that. Again, John Brown of Wamfrey appears a second time here at number 10. His History of the Indulgence. several times during the killing times in order to get Covenanters to fold their tents and come home. The magistrate offered an olive branch called an indulgence. As long as you don't talk about politics from the pulpit, we will allow you to be ministers.
Kind of like the 501c3?
Yeah, it's not wholly unlike that. And it's really the Johnson rule with regard to churches, but yeah. You thank Lyndon Johnson for that. Number 11, Robert McWard. His book called Banders Disbanded. And McWard really discusses the breakdown of covenanting in Scotland and the effects it's having on the church. That was put out during the Killing Times. The Killing Times are going to be the last period of time we discuss. It's at 28 years from between the time of the Restoration and what is called the Glorious Revolution, or the execution of Rennick in 1688. James Rennick, the last official martyr, although he's not really the last one, but he's very often viewed as the last Covenanter martyr. And then the last thing, 12, is Thomas Forrester's book, Rectius Instruendum. And again, this is arguing a lot of points about corruptions that have come into the church, issues of separation from corruption, and Forrester becomes Principal Forrester and a well-respected anti-prelate in the Church of the Revolution. But his work at the time, Shields' writing, is going to be... in fact, Rectius Instruendum, a lot of these works, if we were to look at the title pages, like Lex Rex, Lex Rex was published with the attribution, but I know Rectius Instruendum was not, History of the Indulgence was not, I think Apologetical Relation was not, Naphtali, and so on. A lot of these things were published, they were published during the period of the Restoration, during the Killing Times, were published like Hein Let Loose without the author's name on the title page. Because publishing it was seditious. But the point of bringing that up is to show that Shields is not the only one saying this, nor is he the first one saying this. He's not saying anything that people haven't heard before or couldn't have heard before if they had just read a little bit more widely. All right. Which, according to Shields, is more important concerning these authors? The reason of their authority, or the authority of their reason and why? Well, if he was concerned about the authority of the persons he quotes, the reason of their authority, then he probably wouldn't have referenced a number of books that didn't have author attribution at the time. We know now who wrote them, but he wouldn't have bothered with that. He's concerned to set forth their arguments, and he places a much greater importance upon the authority of their reason. He wants to argue the case reasonably. He's not going to argue from authorities, but he wants to argue authoritatively. So he wants to argue with us logically and from Scripture and logically, and push us to understand. He's not name-dropping. He's not just saying you should believe it because so-and-so says it. He thinks there's actual force in the argument, logical, moral force in the arguments he's about to make. All right, number 8. What is the author's design in this work? He says he wants to essay the discussing the difficulties of all of the conflicts with open enemies and the stated testimony of those who are suffering. He wants to bring it all out into the open. He wants to have a broad discussion of the conflicts that the Covenanters are having with open enemies of what he believes is the stated testimony of the Church of Scotland. Right, 9. Why does Shields include a compendious history of the Church of Scotland? Really, what he's trying to do is demonstrate the conformity of the present sufferers, the Covenanters, with the testimony of Christ's witnesses, particularly in Scotland, throughout all ages. He's trying to show that there's a common thread in and among those who are going to suffer for the truth. Yeah.
There's a historical testimony there?
Yes. He's giving us some historical testimony, and he's telling us that this is a value, and this is, in fact, instructive for us now. We can learn something from them. How did they conduct themselves? How did they prosecute their witness for the testimony of Christ in their day? All right, 10. What did Shields perceive to be the disadvantages of undertaking a hind let loose? He gives us 10 reasons. 10 has 10 reasons. The first thing that he lists is opposition by the enemies of the truth. If you talk about this out loud, you're going to be branded a seditious libeler. Basically stigmatized as a rebel.
Mm-hmm. So if this was happening today, if you write this today, Google and Twitter would be banning his hate speech.
Well, they'd be banning his hate speech, but opposition by enemies of the truth would have probably included they're going to kill you. You know, thankfully, social media doesn't have the authority yet to kill you. But, I mean, if things continue the way they're going, who knows?
So if they mention the Clintons, then they'd be killed.
If they mention any of this stuff that he's going to mention, this is all considered seditious. And they're going to undercut them and destroy them if they talk about it publicly. In fact, if you talk about it privately in the wrong context, somebody's going to turn you in. There are informers everywhere. All right, second. He says the spirit of the age is contrary. You know, it doesn't... what he's going to say has nothing pleasing to what he calls parasitical, a tempered palate of the greatest, not of the best. You can't handle it. You know, people just, they don't want to hear about it.
Much like today,
it's worse than that common maxim, you know, that we shouldn't talk about religion and politics. That's minor in comparison. The spirit of the age is such that they're maybe going to turn you in, you'll get killed. You could be in prison, fined, all kinds of bad things can happen. All right, 3. the subject matter itself is very difficult to set forth. The quality, quantity, and intricacy of the matter are such that he doesn't. He's afraid he can't get it all in a small volume. And if you look at the book, you'll see it's an 800-page volume. He considered that small. Just a little book. Right, fourth, the censorship of the press kept it from being published. He, in other words, there's no place, if he's going to publish this when it gets done, can't do it in Scotland, can't do it in England. In fact, first editions of A Hind Let Loose will be printed in Holland and smuggled back. He smuggled into Scotland.
Wasn't Holland where all the persecuted people went to?
A lot of the persecuted people went to Holland at that time.
Were,
yes.
were they tolerant, or were they actually Protestant?
They were Protestant. They were tolerant. They were in the midst of their own problems, and it's if you're an English speaking minority among a bunch of Dutch speakers who are having a hard time somewhere else, you're not at the center of their attention. And the churches there, a lot of the churches were willing to help those who were in exile. And there's actually a big Scottish expat community in and around Amsterdam during this time. John Brown of Wamphrey was one of the ministers there, as was Robert McWard. So a couple of those people in that book list were actually ministering there at the time. There's others. There were others there as well. Fifth, the poverty of those wishing to publish and those who would purchase it. So even if I write it, I get it published, I get it back here, you know, of course, to get it published, I need money. Don't have that money. And people who need to read it, they don't have the money to purchase it. That was another difficulty. Sixth, the inadequacy of the author for the proposed task. He looked at all that needed to be done and just said, I am not adequate for what is before me. I really don't know that I can do all of this. And he lists all the inadequacies, but I think as much as anything, to be the one who's going to write such a work. Another thing I should point out, Alexander Shields, at the time he writes this book, is 27 years old. He didn't waste his time playing video games and tippling. Seven, the lack of sympathy. And by lack of sympathy, he's singling out not just Reformed churches in general, but fellow Scots in particular. There's a lack of sympathy for suffering upon such heads as they did. A lot of people, the attitude of a lot of people is, they brought this on themselves. Why don't they just conform? You know, if you just give in a little bit, compromise. Hello, guys. Here's a word for you, compromise. Compromise a little bit. You don't have to go to jail. You don't have to die. You don't have to get fined. You don't have to get exiled and all the other horrible things that are happening. So, no, we don't feel sorry for you. Eight. The remnant who suffered was of no reputation among men. This sort of goes with the last one. Lack of sympathy. Amongst a lot of people by this time, they're so weary of this fighting. They just wish the Covenanters would shrivel up and go away. And they just don't like, they're poor people, they're dirty people, they're not you know, they're not high society. No, very, very few people from high society. Not many rich, not many well-connected people by this time are still involved. A lot of them got out a long time ago when they had the opportunity. Right, 9, the peculiar nature of the suffering of the remnant. And that we have to look at under two things, he points out, really. So you can kind of make this, you know, keep 2 points here in number 9, I. First of all, the suffering of the remnant kept them so far separate one from another as to isolate them. Persecution becomes so bad, they could hardly get together to worship together. So they're very much isolated. That's one part of it. But the other thing, and I think this is why so-called Protestants, not only in England, but especially on the continent, are not too sympathetic, and that is the suffering that was inflicted on them was not affected by papists. It was affected by those who professed to be Protestants. They were prelatic, you know, Episcopal in their bearing, but nonetheless, they were Protestant. And for a lot of people who don't speak English, who are sitting on the outside looking in, you know, a lot of European Protestants, if it had been papists, they would have been right there. They would have said, yeah, we understand that, we get that, 100% behind you. When it's somebody who's Protestant, they're trying to think, well, you know, what could be that bad that you couldn't get along with another Protestant? Which is a good question. We're going to get into that. You know, that's why are they being so hard-nosed about this? Frankly, I mean, if Protestantism of the character that they resisted, if that had won out, the doctrine of passive obedience and the idea that the king is law and all of that, that would have been the political theory we would all be strapped with in Western culture now. So the last point, then, is that they were suffering upon new heads for points which nobody hitherto had been called to suffer. Again, if other people had been called to suffer and die, wouldn't have been a big deal. They would have understood that. All right, 11. In what ways, then, according to Shields, has the devil shifted the war against the saints, and, first as to manner and then as to matter? So, as to manner, you know, and he brings up this is a big difference when you move from the sufferings under popery. And under popery, they just took you out and burned you at the stake, very often. Okay, so just very clear. And over. But the manner now consists in several other things. They're coming at you, they're not just going to kill you. First, there's finings. Right? They're going to fine you. They're going to destroy you by finings. Right? Then there are confinings. They're going to put you in prison. Third, there are exactions. And exactions are not finings. Okay? Fining, a fine, is a penalty. An exaction is just a flat-up tax. They're going to tax you. Hey, you don't want to show up to the parish church? That's a fine. Okay? But on top of that, we're going to tax you to support it. We're going to break you financially. We're going to break you physically. We're going to break you mentally. Fourth, extortions. And that's when they make you pay directly at gunpoint. Where they make you do something directly at gunpoint. Under threat of personal harm. And then fifth, impositions of oaths. They make you swear all kinds of unlawful things. You know, they try to. Right, as to matter, and this is where I think they start to lose a lot of people on the continent because they don't see this as clearly as the Scots do. Unlike popery, they're not being persecuted merely for being Protestants, for matters of mere religion. That would have gotten all the other Protestants up in arms. They would have said, whoa, wait a minute. Can't do that. So the ground gets shifted. If you watch, to a certain extent, this is still the, I think, the tactic used by Western governments today. They're persecuted for rebellion and sedition against the king. So we're not going to talk about the religious aspect. That's really what's driving this, but we're going to come after you because you're rebellious and seditious against the king.
I guess they've had to kind of modify that a little bit in Western society where you have the right to, you know, criticize the president without being...
Oh, that, no, no, no. You've got to remember, a lot of that stuff in American jurisprudence arises because of what we're talking about here. What the Covenanters go through is so brutal, and people were familiar enough with it, that it does form part of the conscience of revolutionaries in America. Right, it is having an impact. And it has an impact in Britain, you know, at the time of the Glorious Revolution. 12. What is Shield's source of encouragement amidst these various disadvantages, difficulties, and discouragements? He's got all these things we've just talked about. He's poor, no good place to publish, and nobody's sympathetic and all that stuff. Okay? You got fines, confinings, all these other threats hanging over the head. They're going to accuse me of sedition. So when you take all of that into account, what is the source of encouragement? It's this. He says he took great comfort knowing that the cause of the sufferings was Christ and not himself. He knew he wasn't suffering as an evildoer, but as one who actually had the interests of the spiritual independence and liberty of the church, as well as the liberties of mankind in view. Yeah.
Didn't this guy, Alexander Shields, eventually take the indulgence or...
No.
No? Was it someone else?
He did enter the Revolution Church. That's later.
Oh, okay.
That's a different story, and that would take us into a different trajectory than we're going to get into in Heinlet News. He regretted it, by the way. He did it and then on second thought regretted it but had nowhere to go. By the way, he died in 1700 and he's buried in Port Royal, Jamaica. He was on his way to Darien, which was a Scottish colony in Panama. He's going there to be a minister to get as far away from the Church of Scotland as he could by that time because he was very unhappy with the Revolution settlement. So whatever he thought for a moment, he repented of that and died penitent. He was 40 years old when he died. 13. Does the author intend to give an account of the various defections of the Church of Scotland? Why or why not? And the answer is no. He's not going to. Because from his point of view, adequate accounts have already been given. Those who believed them didn't need any more accounts. You know, some of that is taken up in the books he referenced earlier. Those who believed him didn't need anything else, and those who didn't, he thought would heed no more anyway. Nothing he could say. He couldn't think to add to anything. But the last thing here in the preface 14, who else was being persecuted in Scotland beside the society people or Covenanters at the time the book was written, which, as I told you, was 1687? And the answer is no one. And that's another problem. What he was writing about was falling on the ears of deaf ears, he calls them, of people who are comfortable. They're comfortable. Because they're comfortable, because everything is well with them, they don't really care about what's happening to this little group of people over here. And yet, in the annals of history, this controversy that we're going to talk about with between the Covenanters and the civil government is very much credited with bringing about the revolution that brought William and Mary to the throne and dethroned forever the House of Stuart. So the Covenanters in British history do get credit for that, although they're not happy with the revolution establishment either.
So because this is sort of the prelatic Protestants, if you will, fighting with the Covenanters, is that part of the reason why, for instance, a lot of these guys were able to go to, you mentioned before, Holland, to get these books printed because they weren't contending with sort of the global power of the Roman Church? Or at this point, had the Roman Church kind of, they didn't hold that same global stranglehold that they held?
Well, the Roman Church didn't hold any power at all in Holland by that time.
Okay, gotcha. And the Dutch were just looking at it like the prelates aren't going to come to Holland and start.
No, it wasn't going to start a war there. Nobody was going to start a war. Okay. And it was probably, again, remember, it's being published in a language other than Dutch or Latin. Mm. It's not really going to be a threat to them, even if there was something threatening there. Mm. The Dutch were too busy. They were actually in the midst of their own conflict, as I said. They had been, and they were just off of it. And they were sort of exhausted as a society, arguing this stuff. They just, you know, whatever. So when it came into Holland, they were willing to let it sail through. All right, I want to just get into the introduction material and give you go over. We only have a couple questions here. And that way we'll be set up to start getting into historical material next time. The introduction then. Shields begins his introduction with a view of prophecy. He starts to give us a view of prophecy, and the question is why? And the answer is he wants to set what we would call the eschatological or the cosmic context of the struggles in Scotland for the interest of Christ. And what he's trying to determine is whether or not, in terms of prophecy, the period that we would call the period of the Great Apostasy is nearing its conclusion. So he understands that there's this 1260-year period of apostasy when Rome will be ascendant. He's just trying to figure out when it's going to come to an end. Yeah.
Do you think there's any connection between later on, I guess, in the book, he talks about how the Apostle John was like the first person, the first apostle to evangelize to them? And considering John wrote the Apocalypse, do you think there's a kind of a connection where the Scots kind of have a deeper insight, a clearer insight into prophecy, kind of because...
I wouldn't say they had deeper insight, but I think they felt like they had a very intimate connection with... not only John, but with primitive Christianity.
So they're almost...
And we'll talk about that more when we get into the history, but because it is very interesting how early Christianity can be traced to Scotland. Earlier than most places, and you wouldn't expect that. At least according to their lore, Christianity shows up in Scotland way earlier than makes sense if you look at a map. Because you would think... that it would have showed up in a lot of other places in Europe on its way to getting to Scotland, and it doesn't happen that way. Hmm. Yeah, there's also another thing, and he doesn't get into it too much, but we'll talk about it a little bit when we get to the Chaldees. There's some thought that, and there's some evidence, that there's a relatively close link between Greeks and some of the people end up populating Scotland. There's a question, like, why do we have this, these people genetically closer related, and they're Gaelic, I think somebody has indicated, has some great affinities with Greek, and not with these Romance languages in between. You know, what was going on? Why did Christianity end up there? We don't really have good answers for that. It is very curious, but it's also curious that Scotland historically has sort of been placed. It's almost as if Providence has set Scotland aside to contend during the apostasy with, you know, apostate Christendom. They were set aside. So that's actually what I think Shields is getting at here. That's part of his point, is he's trying to say there's something about, special about Scotland. And when we start looking at the history, you might come to agree with him a little bit. When we start to think about it, it is kind of weird. And he doesn't even get into the half of it. I've looked into some of this stuff. It's strange. It is very strange. And I don't know that I have a good answer, and I'm not sure that we can, because we're talking about history 2,000 years ago, and there just isn't a lot of information, good solid information. But what there is curious. So we'll get into some of that when we get into the history. Hopefully you'll find it interesting, and it'll make you want to look into it yourself a little bit more. All right, 16. What does he view as indicative that the witness for Christ is in a great measure killed? Now remember, this is a question eschatologically. Toward the end of the 1260 years, the prophecy is that the witnesses of Christ will be dead. Basically, there'll be virtually no public witness left. How do you know that you're toward the end of the great apostasy? Virtually no public witness left. Now, if he thought it was the case then, I would contend that we're even closer then to the end of it now. Okay? Because if there were very few people talking about this stuff in his day comparatively, there are even fewer people today. But anyway, he says what is indicative that it's a great measure killed is in the churches. He says the churches in the land, there's no persecution, although the iniquity of the land is so great. Therefore, he reasons the witness of Christ is already dead among such bodies. Right? There's no persecution. Spiritually, they're degenerate. They're not being persecuted. They're not contending for the truth. Maybe this is the death of the witnessing church. Maybe I'm witnessing that. I don't think he's quite there yet, but I understand why he thinks that. And eschatologically, it's a different question. We talked about that some with when we were going through Bible prophecy. I think there's good reason for him to be thinking that way. Uh, 17. For what does our author plead respecting the Church of Scotland with reference to the Reformed Churches of France, Hungary, Piedmont? By Piedmont, he's referring to the Waldenses, etc. And here's what he says. He says, look, the Reformed Church of Scotland should be included in the number of churches suffering for the cause of Christ, even though their suffering is primarily at the hands of prelacy and not popery. You know, the Waldenses suffered terribly at the hands of the Papists, the French Reformed, and the Hungarian Reformed all suffer severely at the hands of Papists. But that's not the case in Scotland. Scots are not suffering at the hands of Papists so much. They did a little bit, but the big suffering in Scotland is actually the hands of prelates, and that brings us back to that question of, you know, Protestants persecuting Protestants? What? What's going on? Now, at this time, he raises the question of the reputation of the Church of Scotland. And he says it stood in several things. The first, in terms of Reformed churches, and I would argue, and I think he's alluding to this in his history, that actually the antiquity of Christianity in Scotland is part of the reason they have these characteristics more than European churches that become Reformed. Because they've had a longer history of pure doctrine, and during the course of that long history, the part of it which was eclipsed by popery was smaller for them than for these other countries. So first, he says it's famous for its unity, which during the Reformation and the Second Reformation was true. It was famous for its unity to a greater degree than other Reformed churches. Covenanted uniformity among Presbyterians is the backdrop of a unity that a lot of other Reformed churches, in their purity, wondered how they could emulate that. In fact, that's why they were called into England when, at the time of the Westminster Assembly, to help the English reform their church. They wanted Scotland's help specifically. Right? And that's one reason. Two, it was faithful in verity, upholding the truth in the finer points. Now, the churches were upholding the bigger points, but Scotland was not just upholding the big stuff. They had it down, and they were there on a lot of the finer points as well. And then third, it was fruitful in purity, bearing testimony to the life and power of true godliness. And he lists, again, four things. Doctrine. This is a small, lower cap, A, B, C, D. Doctrine, worship, discipline, and government. There was a purity in the Church of Scotland with regard to each of them, unparalleled in the other Reformed churches. Was there confessional integrity in other Reformed churches? Yes. But no one reached this kind of purity and consistency in Reform. And again, I would suggest that a large part of that is they weren't as far away from a more primitive Christianity as some of the others. They had only come under the cloud of popery for, you know, four centuries or so. And while it had its effect, it didn't have the kind of effect it had elsewhere. The Scots were very decentralized. It just never got the kind of grip, even over four centuries, that Romanism had managed to gain over a lot of other people in Europe. Right, 19, and the last question then. What is Shield's proposed method of prosecuting his plan in this book? So three things, he says. First, he wants to summarize the series succession, success, and result of the contendings of the Church of Christ in Scotland from time to time. So it's a summarize history. Series, succession, success, and result of the contendings of the Church of Christ in Scotland from time to time. The second is he wants to rehearse the means, methods, and measures that the popish, prelatic, and malignant factions have used to mutilate and fragment the covenanted Church of Scotland. So he's going to give us a history. Then he's going to tell us how they broke up, how these various groups got in there and destroyed the covenanted Church of Scotland. And then third, clearing and vindicating the heads upon which those during the killing times were called to suffer. So the last part of the book will be about those heads of suffering. Right, so that's basically a survey of the introduction of as well as the preface. And with that, next time we're going to start getting into the historical material and talking about the actual history of the Church of Scotland.